Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Marie Beyer. Let's get growing.
Hi, listeners. I'd like to invite you to visit our website at organicgardenerpodcast.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter, download our ebook on organic gardening basics, and get started on building your very own organic oasis today. Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast today. I'm super excited to introduce my guest, Jenny Jackson from Jenny Jack Sun Farm that she runs with her husband in Pine Mountain, Georgia. They're just south of Atlanta. They grow fruits, vegetables, herbs, flowers on 5 acres and recently added heritage hogs to the mix. So we haven't had anybody talk about hogs, so it'll be exciting today. I think you'll be excited to hear this interview. So welcome to the show, Jenny.
Thank you.
And go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, so my husband and I have been running the farm full-time for 8 years now. We met at University of Georgia. I studied horticulture, and he was an education major. So I was interested in the idea of farming in college, but I wasn't really exposed to small, diverse farms until after I graduated. So I knew I wanted to study plants and how they grow and how to grow them, but I didn't have a clear path until we traveled after we graduated college, and we went to Hawaii to work on different organic farms.
Oh, cool. Did you go through the woofer program, or you just went to Hawaii? Like, how'd you get there? Oh, you did. Okay.
Yep. A friend that had traveled extensively told us about WOLF, and that is an acronym for Willing Workers on Organic Farms. You can do it pretty much anywhere in the world. And so we decided we wanted to do it in Hawaii. We wanted to go there, but we knew it would be expensive as a tourist. So by wolfing, we were able to work in exchange for a place to stay and food. And by a place to stay, I mean a tent.
tent's probably okay in Hawaii.
Absolutely. I mean, it's the ideal place to camp for several months. So, so we stayed there for about 5 months, working on 3 different farms. Oh. And that's where we, didn't get real in-depth education, because as a wolfer, you work about 25 hours a week. That way you have time to explore the area that you're in. So it was a good introduction, but when we came back to Georgia after Hawaii, we found a longer-term apprenticeship, and that's where we really started learning what we would apply to our farm.
Awesome. Okay, I think that's great advice, and I love to hear about experiences like that, because I think it is a good way to get started. Learning is to do an apprenticeship, because it's a lot of work. And one, you'll learn how to be more effective and more efficient. And also you can really decide, is this what I want to do, before you make a big commitment?
Exactly.
Guess said something about you need to learn how to manage 1 acre before you try to manage 20 acres. So.
Right. Exactly.
That's a good way. And I had one of my very first guests, Todd Aluzio, I always forget how to say his name, but he did an apprenticeship and he really liked it, because he said it was no risk and you're learning mm-hmm. from the person whose farm it's on. So
yeah,
lots of good reasons to try that. Okay. Well, I do always kind of like to start the show by asking my guests about their very first gardening experience. Like, how old were you? Were you a kid, an adult? Who were you with? What'd you grow? Like, what was your very first gardening experience?
Well, I was really fortunate. I grew up in the garden. My parents had a big garden. So although I didn't fully appreciate it when I was younger and, you know, help as much as I'm sure I should have, I at least had exposure to it. Something really I just took for granted that you could grow food and harvest it and eat it, you know, so fresh. And also we had a babysitter that was, a serious gardener. So when I wasn't at home with my parents, from the time I was just a few months old, she had us in her garden, just watching us while she tended her garden. So, I feel really lucky that I was exposed to it, my whole life, basically.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to tell us what organic gardening or earth-friendly gardening means to you?
Yeah. Well, basically, there's so many toxins in our environment today, and a lot of them come from agriculture. So when I started learning about, you know, the health hazards of conventional fertilizers, pesticides, herbicides, number one, I didn't really want to expose myself or my husband or our workers to that. But then when you're growing food to sell to other people, you want to make sure it's as healthy and safe as possible too. So for me, not only is it about care for the soil, but it's about keeping myself and my husband and our customers as healthy as possible. And I just personally, from what I have learned about conventional fertilizers and chemicals, I don't think it's possible to do it otherwise.
I agree. I know sometimes I think it's crazy. I'm like, how are we eating this stuff?
Yeah.
Okay. So then who or what inspired you to start using organic techniques? Like, did you learn about that when you were at school or when you were doing the woofing projects or your parents or?
No, not my parents. They were, you know, just sort of not old fashioned, but, I guess mainstream gardeners, you know, they used triple 13 or whatever conventional fertilizer people use on gardens. And I do think it's better, to grow your own food if you, you know, if that's the only way you are going to do it, I think it's better than not doing it at all. But, for them, it was just a lack of knowledge about organic growing methods. So I wasn't exposed to organic growing ideas until college, I guess. It's not something that I was taught through horticulture. I was at UGA from 2000 to 2004, and it was shortly after I left that they started focusing more on organic methods. So I didn't really learn about it in college, but I did get interested in it as I read about the hazards of conventional farming just on my own. And so it was in Hawaii when we were working on these organic farms that I really, you know, became aware of the importance of growing organically.
Awesome. I just talked to someone from Hawaii. She's going to be my guest, I think, like number 103 or something. She's coming soon. She has a place called Squash and Awe in Hawaii. Anna Peach is her name. So cool. Well, maybe I can get some farms from you, some names that of people I could interview too from those places that you worked. Okay, so then tell us about something that grew well this year.
Our tomatoes were phenomenal this year. We have just recently put up a couple of hoop houses. So that is like a greenhouse, except you grow in the ground. It's basically a high tunnel of plastic over a growing field. And this year we had our tomatoes growing in two of our hoop houses, and it made such a difference by having the plastic over them. We could get them in the ground earlier by avoiding rainfall. We could, you know, manipulate the water just as we need it, which is so important, especially for cherry tomatoes that will split if you get too much rain. It also really reduced foliar disease because the rain wasn't splashing soil back up on the leaves, and the plants were able to stay drier. So less cracking, less disease, longer season. We had a really great tomato crop.
Awesome. Those are great tips for listeners. So in Georgia, I wouldn't think that you'd have to worry about a longer season, but you do down there, I guess. What's your climate like?
Well, we've got a really great long growing season, but our frost-free date in the spring is April 15th. So in order to get stuff in earlier that's frost sensitive, all the summer stuff, tomatoes, squash, cucumbers, yeah, the hoop house is the way to do it. And because we're growing and marketing vegetables for a living, you know, the earlier we can get these things in, the better, because people, our customers are highly anxious to start getting those first summer fruits in late spring.
So then do you plant some outside too, or just all your tomatoes are in the hoop house?
This year we did a third planting outside, because our first two plantings were inside, so the hoop houses were full. So yeah, we did a third planting in August outside, and we harvested those tomatoes up until our first frost, which was, around, late November.
Wow. Okay, cool. All right. How about, is there something new or different you're excited to try next year?
Well, something that I've really gotten interested in this year is medicinal herbs and plants.
Oh, awesome.
So we have started into that. Primarily, we grow vegetables. We do have fruit also, chickens for eggs, and the hogs. So obviously, we're very diverse, but I really have enjoyed opening up another layer of diversification through these medicinal herbs, and our customers have really been interested in it as well. I think as people learn more about the healing power of plants and herbs, these are the types of people that are shopping with us anyway for their fruits and vegetables. They're very anxious to try these things. So I'm excited about doing more of those things and learning more for next season.
Okay. Do you want to tell us like any medicinal herbs that you planted this year or that you're like give us some examples?
So comfrey is one non-edible, but that's probably the first thing I got started with. I had a customer that gave me a plant and she didn't tell me a whole lot about it, but I attended a herbal class at a Georgia Organics conference, which is our local or our state's nonprofit that educates folks on organic growing methods. And so I learned about the healing powers of comfrey. So I started making a salve with it. I guess I started that just as a Christmas gift last year. And the people I gave it to gave me such good feedback that I decided to make it and sell it here at our on-farm market. And it sold really quickly. People were telling me that it was helping heal all sorts of skin conditions, you know, minor skin conditions like rashes and just minor cuts and bruises. So, I've gotten really excited about comfrey. Ginger and turmeric are two more crops that we grew this year. We grew those as edibles, you know, just for culinary use initially, but then I started looking into the medicinal qualities of both those plants. So we've dried a lot of those things for tea, and I've just started making tincture with those as well.
Awesome. Those are great tips. And one of my guests talked about if there were two things you could put in the ground, one was comfrey and the other was borage. Because I think they also, not only because of their healing, but I want to say it's because they bring in the pollinators.
Yes, the bees
and stuff.
Yeah, the bees love the comfrey flowers. They're so beautiful. It's similar to borage in that they're like bell-shaped. And when it blooms in the spring, I've noticed the bees all over it.
Awesome. Okay. Do you want to tell us about something that didn't work so well this season? Was there something that didn't go quite as you planned?
Let's see. Well, we have a lot of fire ant pressure here.
Oh.
It is our number one pest, and so each year they actually get worse. There's only one thing that we're aware of that you can use organically against fire ants. It's called spinosad, and It's very expensive, but I did splurge on some because the ants not only seem to eat certain seeds like beets,
That's what I
and
was
I'm
going to
talking.
ask. What do the ants do? They eat your
Yeah,
seeds. Okay.
it's hard to tell, of course, with the seed underground,
Right.
but when things don't germinate, we start looking closely at the soil and we see a ton of ants and I have seen ants carrying off some seeds.
Wow.
Yeah. But not only do they eat the seeds, but once they germinate, they eat the plants. So they just chew at the stems before the plant can even really get started. And what they're doing now is even on mature plants, they will get they'll start feeding right at the base of the stem and weaken the plant until it dies. So fire ants are a huge problem for us. I would love to participate in some sort of university study to see if there's alternatives to the spinosad because, well, number one, it's expensive, and number two, you have to spray the mound or the ants directly. We've tried the bait granules, which I didn't find those to be effective, and they're also expensive, so I didn't test that any further. So, yeah, that's just something that we struggle with every year, but it seemed to have been worse this year.
So, I don't know how much this would help you because it's, I don't. So, there's this guy in Canada that I interviewed, Peter Jordan, and he's starting to produce these things called seed havens. And they're like these white plastic kind of border tray type of things that keep out, I'm pretty sure they keep out crawling insects. But he's up in Canada. I don't think they have it that you can get them in the United States. And also, I have a feeling it's more for like a home guard, like a smaller thing, but eventually I would think, but that might be something down the line that's going to work. But they were pretty cool. You could, I'll put the link in and send you the link to his website. It's called Seed Haven. And because they had a big problem with crawling insects up where he was. So that might be something down the line that might work.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, that's interesting. Fire ants, huh?
Yes, they are the worst.
They sound nasty. Do they bite besides?
Oh yeah, they bite. And it's painful.
Okay. How about something that you find is easy to grow and is generally successful every time? Is there something that works really good down there?
Yeah, well, there's a few things that seem to be relatively carefree for vegetables. Garlic is one. We always have good luck with garlic. We save our seed each year, which I love being able to do that. We're not really set up to save a lot of seed on our farm because we're a small farm and we're focusing on production. So we don't have enough time to devote to it or isolation distance to keep the seed pure. But of course, garlic, you just save your bulbs and plant cloves from those bulbs for the following season. So I love being able to save the seed for garlic, and we always have a good success with that because, well, the fire ants don't eat garlic so far. Deer don't eat it, so yeah, no major pests or diseases as of yet. Sunchokes are one of my favorite crops because they're so carefree. Jerusalem artichokes, it is the root of a sunflower, and it's edible. Very delicious. It's a very nutritious crop, and because it's native to this area, I believe it's native to the whole eastern U.S. Very drought tolerant and just carefree.
And they have those pretty little sunflowers, like you said.
Yeah, which is great for the bees when not a whole lot is blooming in late summer. They start blooming here in August and go through September, so that's a really nice time to have to provide some pollen and nectar for the bees.
Cool. Okay. How about something you would steer new gardeners away from that you find is typically challenging to grow in your climate?
Well, we have a big problem with squash vine borers. So, for winter squashes, we typically just grow varieties that are of the Machata species. Uh-huh. So that is butternut squash. Some other examples are Long Island cheese, which is like a round pumpkin. It looks like a pumpkin, although it's technically a winter squash. Pennsylvania Dutch crookneck is another type. Seminole. So these are all varieties, like I said, that are in that Machata species. And what happens with those is the stem of the plant gets woody very quickly, so they're more resistant to the vine borer. So, yeah, I think I hear home gardeners, you know, say they have trouble with pumpkins. And I think that's one reason is because of the vine borer down here. But also planting early is key for a lot of cucurbits here. And I think people think pumpkins fall, so they try to plant midsummer, but really the pest pressure is just too high. That's when we've got our hottest temperatures. So yeah, if you could plant those things earlier, harvest them late summer, and they'll store until the fall.
Wow. You're full of great information and knowledge, and just and I think I guess maybe I haven't had a lot of people from the South, so I think a lot of listeners are gonna be excited to hear this episode. Okay, so what's your least favorite activity to do in the garden? Is there something you have to force yourself to get out there and do?
I really don't like dealing with row cover. So that is like a thin sheet that's made for plants to cover them up, to protect them either from frost or pests. Mm-hmm. And I love, you know, the benefits that row cover provides, but it is just something that I really don't like dealing with. Usually it's windy, of course, on the day we decide to put it out. So it's flapping everywhere. And yeah, I just really do not like it.
Mm-hmm. Cool. All right. How about on the flip side, what's your favorite activity to do in the garden?
So many things. I love harvesting, especially things that are in the ground, like the sunchokes I was talking about earlier, sweet potatoes, things that it feels like digging up a little treasure every time you find one. Mm-hmm. That's probably one of my favorite things is digging roots in the ground. We have an on-farm market at our farm every Wednesday, April through December. And I love dealing or interacting with our customers because they come to the farm to pick out their produce. And so they can walk around and see the pigs and chickens and all the crops. And so I really love that aspect of our business too, just having people on the farm and seeing where their food's coming from, seeing the farmers grow their food. That's definitely one of my favorite parts about direct marketing.
Awesome. Now, do you want to tell us a little bit about, didn't I see on your website that do you have helpers or something? I mean, it's not just you and your husband for 5 acres, right?
Right. Yeah. So, we take two apprentices each season, and they're seasonal, so they start typically in February and work through November. So this is different from the wolfing apprenticeship that Chris and I did. With wolfing, there's typically no money exchanged, and usually it's folks that are more interested in traveling and just like a different type of experience that are wolfing, not necessarily folks that are seriously interested in agriculture. Oh. As a career. So our apprenticeship is set up with the idea that we are helping to grow more farmers. So each year we take two apprentices, and not everyone has gone on to farm, maybe half in our 8 years. Mm-hmm. But it's a good way for folks to get a full season experience of what it's like to be on a farm, to work on a farm, the lifestyle. So it's a good way for folks to figure out if it's something they want to pursue. So yeah, those two people work full time with us. And then we have volunteers that come not every week, and it's not something we can rely on heavily, right. But Yeah, volunteers definitely help us with big projects like planting strawberries or garlic.
Okay.
And then we have one part-time employee that's local.
That's like comes back all the time, you mean?
Yeah, that's new for us. We only had one apprentice this year. I'm not sure why it worked out that way, but this is the first year we've only hired one person. Mm-hmm. And so we were looking for another employee, and one of our best customers had expressed interest in working part-time. So, yeah, she came on in February and has worked out just perfectly. So luckily, she's going to be back next year.
Oh, cool.
And, we're still going to take two apprentices. We're just, I think, with increasing the medicinal part of the herb side of the business, it'll be nice to have extra hours for her to help me with that.
Cool. I like that. And so then I guess, are you saying that then you pay your apprentices like a small stipend or something too as well?
Yes.
So that the woofing program does them? Excellent.
Yep. Yeah. So they get paid. They get food from the farm and housing.
Oh, nice. Okay. How about, do you want to tell us about the best crop you ever grew? Was there one year where things were just so prolific you couldn't give them all away? You didn't know what to do with it all?
Well, that happened this year with the ginger, actually.
Really?
I've been wanting to grow ginger for a few years, but it's actually hard to get the seed because it's in such demand. And I guess most of it that's grown organically comes from Hawaii, from one particular farm, and they've got a waiting list to get their seed. So I've been waiting for a few years, finally got the seed this year, planted more than we needed because I had read it's a demanding crop that's pretty difficult to get high yields from. Mm-hmm. But we did really well with it. So we had hundreds of pounds of ginger, fresh baby ginger, and you know, much more than our CSA members could use. So yeah, when we have extra things like that, we typically try to sell those to chefs in Atlanta, and we were able to move it all to these high-end restaurants in Atlanta.
Excellent. What a great idea. Did you save some of that seed then, I hope?
Well, actually, it doesn't make much sense for us to save ginger seed because it's a tropical. It has to be kept above, I believe, 60 degrees.
Oh.
And we don't keep a greenhouse heated through the winter. So for us to provide the right conditions for it, I think would actually end up costing us more in energy to keep it warm enough than to just reorder the seed from the company. Also, we retail it from anywhere from $10 to $16 a pound, and it only costs $8 a pound, even with shipping from Hawaii. So, yeah, not to save the seed.
So just my show lately, it just seems like since episode 100, we've been talking a lot about seed saving. Just something that other guests have talked about is that when you save the seeds, the next year they're going to grow a little better in your climate. So you might think about just saving a few just for that purpose. Maybe you'll, I don't know. So, but I'm just curious. So when you say it has to be kept above 60 degrees, the seeds have to be kept above 60 degrees, or the plant, like, why would you keep it? Like, couldn't you just keep them in the house, or like the plants have to be kept at that long before they go to seed that you'd be heating a greenhouse? Is that what you mean?
Well, for ginger seed, you actually plant the rhizome. So that's the part that you eat when you use ginger. I could keep it
big.
They're bigger. I'm not sure that you can just keep them. Well, see, for us, and probably anybody growing ginger in North America, you harvest it when it's baby ginger. So it takes much longer for it to develop into mature ginger that's got the skin on it.
I got it.
So when we harvest it, it has no skin and it's pretty perishable. So, I'm not sure how we would keep it over the winter, even if we could keep it, you know, at the correct temperature. We'd probably have to protect it in soil. I know that we couldn't just keep it out, which is what we do for like we do save our sweet potato seed, which is just a matter of saving sweet potatoes. And of course, we can keep those in our house. But yeah, it wouldn't be the same with ginger because it is not cured.
Okay, cool. See, you are just the knowledge full of information. All sorts of things that we haven't talked about or I didn't know about or things listeners, I'm sure, are going to be excited about. And it's interesting because I'm pretty sure there was a girl up here, like really close to me. I want to say it was that was growing ginger and turmeric. Sarah Harding. Sarah Harding's her name. And her from Buggy Road Farm. She was just on like a few like in the 90s, episodes in the 90s. And she, I want to say, grew turmeric and ginger this year. But it was a lot harder, I think, for her. And I'm not sure they were going to do it again next year. But
yeah, she's really in, like, required warm temperatures. Montana.
Huh?
It really requires warm temperatures.
Yeah. Okay. How about a favorite tool that you like to use? Like if you had to move and could only take one tool with you, what could you not live without?
Probably the scuffle hoe. Also known as the stirrup hoe.
Oh,
uh-huh. Do you know what that is?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But you could tell listeners.
So yeah, it is a hoe that is shaped like a stirrup. And it is really effective for weeding when the weeds are small. It's not something that you can take in to a field where there's big clumps of grass or, you know, weeds that have got a really big, deep root system. But if you're cultivating an area that is just starting to sprout weeds, what you do is basically sweep it along the surface of the soil, and it uproots those weeds while you're sweeping it across. So there's no picking up, like with a traditional hoe, picking it up and chopping at the ground. It's just a very fast, effective way to get an area clean.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of like, I think, one of my husband's biggest successes, because we just don't get the weeds that other people do. And I think partly it's because he just knocks them out right away. He like goes through his soil ahead of time and pulls out any like tiny little white shot of crabgrass, you know, smaller than my pinky. He sees it, it's out of there. But then the next step is as soon as they're starting to come, because I was really worried, like our thing has been water, and so we finally put in a deep well last year, and so he planted like this little mini farm this year, and I was so worried when I saw like the sprinkler going around, because the first time we've ever had a sprinkler. Usually we've always had just like tiny bits of water, so all the water always went to the roots of the plants. Like there was no extra water, there were no weeds getting watered. So this year with that sprinkler I was worried, but he did not really have a huge weed problem, and I think it's because he does that. He gets those weeds out of there when they're new.
Yeah, it's so much more effective to do it when they're small because it's so much faster. You don't have to spend time yanking big roots up.
And it's not as overwhelming. You're not like, oh, I got to weed that huge patch.
Yeah, exactly.
And then I had another guest who's kind of in, well, at least she's in the southeast, in the Appalachia area of Kentucky. And she was talking about her husband wanted to buy this, I think it was the exact same kind of hoe, for $125. And she was, you know, they were at some ag fair or something. And she's asking the salesman, what in the world could possibly be worth, you know? But she said it's the best thing she ever bought. And she just loves it.
Yeah.
Because it was, I don't know if it was super sharp, but she said the same thing like you, like sweeping those weeds away.
Mm-hmm.
So she really liked that. Joyce Pinson from Friends Drift In Farm. Yeah, she talked about that too. Cool. Okay. So one of my big challenges is always eating or harvesting vegetables on time. Now, I know, you know, your situation's a little bit different because you have a farm and that's, but do you have any tips for like, because I just seem to always get so overwhelmed. And again, this year, I had the question in the beginning and then I took it out and then I put it right back in because when the fall came, here I was with like a basket of eggplants and a basket of peppers. And it just seems like everything comes on at the same time. So do you have any suggestions for what you do in that case?
Yeah, we do a lot of food preserving. So I know, you know, if you've got a busy schedule, full-time job, it could be challenging to find the time because it is time consuming to either can or freeze. But yeah, when we've got a glut of something like eggplant or tomatoes, we just make the time to can, freeze, dry, and preserve it for the winter. Because although we have a good selection of greens and roots in our climate throughout the winter that we can just harvest straight from the garden. Mm-hmm. It's nice to have that taste of summer, either in jars or in the freezer. So I was surprised, like with eggplant, I was surprised. It actually freezes really, really well if you roast it first. Yeah.
Wow. I should have done that.
Yeah. Okay. So you can roast it first until it's soft. And then just freeze the pulp, which is really nice for sauces or stews. I haven't tried like a baba ganoush or anything like that with the frozen pulp, but I know it's really nice for sauces to mix in with tomatoes for a pasta sauce.
So I just have to ask, what about the, like, do you peel it before you cook it, or you peel it after, or do you freeze it with the peel, or how does that work?
Yeah, so the peel would be too tough frozen, so I just make a few slits in a whole eggplant, bake it until it's really soft, which takes about, depending on the size of the eggplant, 30, 45 minutes, and then I scoop that pulp out of the skin, so I do not freeze it with the skin.
Oh, awesome. Okay, cool. Because I had way too many eggplants this year that I couldn't keep up with.
Yeah.
And that would have been a great thing. But next year, so yeah. The chickens loved them. How about, I tried to make eggplant parmesan out of all of them, and I got one batch done, and then the second batch I just never got time to. But
yeah, that's time consuming.
Yeah. So, and like you said, you know, I work full time, and it just hit me at the wrong time. I didn't realize how many were down there under the plants, I guess, and I should have just been eating them more along the lines, and I don't know. How about you did give us some secrets for preserving food. Do you have any special techniques for cooking weird or unusual foods, or any weird or unusual ways for cooking ordinary foods?
Well, when people are unsure about different foods, I usually suggest to roast them. There's so many vegetables that are delicious roasted. For example, sunchokes. It's one of my personal favorites, but a lot of people are intimidated by it just because they haven't seen it, they haven't cooked with it. But they are super delicious, just simply roasted with salt and pepper, olive oil, and finished with a little lemon juice. So for a lot of root crops, you can even mix them up, just chop them into evenly sliced pieces. I typically do like sunchokes, carrots, and beets, probably half inch piece chunks. And I don't peel root vegetables that come from our farm anyway. I know that they don't have anything that's unhealthy, you know, as far as pesticides, herbicides on them. And because they're so fresh, the peeling isn't very thick. So that's one step that you can skip. I think a lot of people just peel things out of habit, but it's really not necessary, especially if you're growing your own. So just give a root vegetable a good scrub under running water, chop them up, roast them, and that really intensifies the flavors, and it's just super easy.
Awesome. I love that too. I hardly ever peel anything. And when I was in college, there was even a restaurant in our little town called Tori's Home Cooking, and they would sell food that they grew on their farm, and they were famous for their mashed potatoes that they made that had the skins on them.
Oh yeah.
And they were really good, and people were always surprised, but they were delicious. So I rarely ever take the skins off of food. I might, you know, like cut out, like if there's a mark or something on it. But
right. Yeah.
For the most part. Yeah. I really like the peels. Excellent. Oh, you are just full of great things. Okay. How about, what's your favorite recipe you like to cook from the garden?
I love to make a gratin with most anything. So that is like a casserole that is creamy and topped with cheese, and so you can pretty much use lots of combination of vegetables to make a delicious gratin. One of my favorites in the summer would be to cook down tomatoes, eggplant, zucchini or squash together with garlic and onion, and then you pour some cream or milk over that. top it with fresh grated Parmesan or cheddar, any cheese would go with those vegetables pretty much. And then you bake it in the oven until it's all set. You can add breadcrumbs to the top too if you want to make it a little heartier. And you can do that with so many things: cauliflower, broccoli, greens, any greens you could chop up, wilt down in a pan with garlic, olive oil, onion. And it's just such a simple filling meal with, a side of a salad and some bread. It's just super fast.
Are you going to make a cookbook soon?
Actually, we have a friend that's a chef, and we have a annual farm dinner, and she cooks all the food from the farm, and we usually have about 200 guests that are seated right by the fields. And I would love for her to do a cookbook one day with our food.
Do you do like a newsletter for your CSA people with like recipes in it? I know one of my guests talked about that, and I thought that was a great idea.
Before we deliver their share, usually the day before, I send a harvest list via email, and so they know what to expect in their box. And in that list, I'll include recipes, especially if it's something more unusual that they'll be getting that week, recipes and cooking tips. And then also, Chris writes a weekly newsletter. It's a blog, so you can go to our website and just sign up for it. You don't have to be a CSA member to receive that. And he basically just lets people know what's going on at the farm that week and includes some pictures.
Okay, tell us what the website is, because listeners are listening.
Yeah, it's jennyjackfarm.com.
Okay. Yeah, I think they're gonna like that, and they might start requesting your newsletter too, for the recipes.
Oh,
Okay.
sure.
How about a favorite internet resource? Is there someplace you like to go online to learn about farming or gardening or doing different things? Cooking.
Atra is a great
Oh,
resource.
cool. Okay.
Yeah, so that's attra.org. And Atra is full of information about sustainable farming. And that's actually where we find our apprentices, or rather, where our apprentices find us, because farms throughout the country can list their apprenticeship on that website. And it's in a database, so folks can search according to state. And yeah, so that's a great resource all around for us.
Cool. That's where that guy Todd from Two Bear Farm got his found his apprenticeship, and that was his resource too. So that's excellent, because he was way back like episode two or something when I very first started. Okay. How about a favorite reading material? Is there like a book or a magazine or a blog that you can recommend?
Yeah, I really like Growing for Market.
Ooh,
Now that's geared more towards production farms, but there's lots of good information in that. It's a like a magazine that we get, but they have an online version as well.
Awesome. Okay. How about, do you have any business advice for like listeners who might want to get started selling maybe some extra produce or how to get started? Like when you first started out, did you start with a CSA or how did you guys
We
get started?
started as a CSA farm, except we partnered with another farm. So there were two of us providing for 100 member CSA in Atlanta, two farms, that is. So all the pressure wasn't on us. A CSA is it's a lot of pressure. We're very thankful for it because it allows us to actually make a living doing this. The markets in this area aren't reliable enough for us to go to a farmer's market every week and ensure that we're going to sell everything. So for us, CSA is the way we're able to ensure a living. And even though it's really challenging, it requires us to be very organized. So we partnered with the other farm for the first couple of years. And then once we were more confident, we just went out on our own. But yeah, so CSA is a great way for small growers to make a living doing this. I guess I would just suggest not getting too big too quickly, because one of the problems with CSAs is customers just aren't happy. If they're not getting the selection or the variety that they anticipated. So I would suggest if you're going that route, start small and build it from there. Oftentimes, if you have extra produce and you've got a small CSA, you can find other outlets for it, like restaurants or farmers markets. But to retain those members, you really want to make it good. You want to give them the best that you possibly can give them, a good selection. And I don't think that you can do that by having a big CSA right away.
Mm-hmm. And I think, like, when you say start small, you mean like 10 to 20 customers, right?
Yeah, I guess it would be different for each situation, depending on how much land you're growing on, how much help you have. Mm-hmm. But yeah, if it's a two-person operation growing on an acre or less, mm-hmm. I would think starting with less than 25 members would be ideal.
And I'm just going to tell listeners, if you are new to the show, a CSA means community-supported agriculture, right?
Community-supported yes. agriculture.
Mm-hmm. And it's like where customers buy shares, right? And then each month or each week they get like a little basket of whatever you've grown on your farm for that month. And it kind of helps farmers get started.
Right.
What was I going to say? So I'm just curious, like, how did you, like, when you went off on your own, did you have to find your own customers completely, or did some of your customers go with you, or how did that work?
Yeah, so we were going up to Atlanta to do that, the CSA in the first couple of years. Uh-huh. Atlanta was just such an easy market because there's so many people up there, you know, looking for this product. Where we are, we're about an hour and a half southwest of Atlanta.
Oh.
And, you know, we had just kind of assumed it would be harder to make a living in this area. Plus, the farm that we apprenticed on was near Atlanta, so we just had connections up in that area initially. But then once people in this area heard what we were doing, there was a lot of folks that were ready to jump in. So there were a couple of newspaper articles written about the farm in the local papers. Mm-hmm. And when folks read about it, just called us right away. And we had 30 members before we knew it. And it just grew from there. We've had as many as 150 members. But since we've increased our pig operation, we're back down to 100 so that we can split our time between the animals and the vegetables.
Do you want to tell us anything about the pig operation? Like, why'd you choose pigs? What are they adding? You know, where, like, how's that going? Do your CSA customers get, like, bacon or something? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, so it's not part of the CSA. Our CSA is just fruits, vegetables, and herbs. The pork part of our farm is separate. So CSA customers or just any customer can buy pork separately.
Oh, okay.
We got interested in it, number one, because we love pork. We had seen or read about other small farms that had incorporated pigs into their operation. Pigs, for the most part, are easy to contain in an electric fence. That's one of the most limiting factors, I think, about raising animals is fencing. Mm-hmm. Because it's so expensive. Mm-hmm. But pigs are really intelligent, and they respect electricity really, really well. So fencing is relatively cheap. We just use step-in posts, like fiberglass or plastic posts, and poly wire. And then we connect a charger to that in each paddock. And so it's pretty inexpensive. We like the personality of pigs. They're smart and they're fun to watch. And for the most part, they're pretty easy to work with. And, you know, they're not aggressive. they have a very fast gestation. It's 3 months, 3 weeks, and 3 days. So you can produce quite a few pigs in a short amount of time. Our farm is set on my parents' land, and there's quite a few hardwoods around the edges of our vegetable fields. And we thought that would be a really great place to raise pigs, and it turns out it is, because it provides a lot of shade, and they can forage on the acorns in the fall.
Oh.
So, yeah, basically we were looking for a way to utilize more of the land that my parents had available. And, yeah, we just got interested in pigs and started breeding last year. And so now we're up to about 30.
Oh, you are? Okay. I was going to ask that, how many you had about. Awesome. I laughed because, so my husband and I, we just got sheep. Like, I think we've barely had them for a month. And the other day I took them out some oats and the ram totally butted me right in the leg, and I have this huge black and blue mark from the ram, and I'm just like, oh my goodness.
Yeah, we thought
I'm giving
about...
you oats and you ram me.
Yeah, that's not very nice. We thought about sheep and goats. We didn't really give cows much thought because that requires better fencing and a truck and a trailer to haul them. Which we have a truck to haul produce, but we don't have any sort of large trailer. So we kind of gave all those animals some thought. And for a vegetable operation, we were just too concerned that the sheep or goats would get out and eat things.
Mm-hmm.
One of my guests
just talked about that too, about keeping the sheep away from the important crops and making sure that, you know, if they're fenced up next to the kale doesn't have one of those portable fences, that it has a strong fence, because he said they would just destroy it in no time.
Yeah, we were just too nervous about grazing animals like that getting out and destroying our vegetable field. So far, luckily, the pigs haven't done that. They do like vegetables, but we throw them scraps and things. Plus, they each have big areas to graze, grass and wooded lots, so they stay pretty happy in their fence.
Okay, cool. All right, here's my final question. It's kind of a doozy, though. Get ready. If there's one change you would like to see to create a greener world, what would it be? For example, is there a charity or organization you're passionate about, or a project you would like to see put into action? Like, what do you feel is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either locally, nationally, or on a global scale?
That's a big one. Food waste is a big concern of mine. When I found out that Americans typically throw away half the food, fresh food that they purchase, that just really turns my stomach, especially when I think about, you know, folks purchasing our food that we've worked so hard for and then just letting it waste. I think that, there's a lot of hunger out there, a lot of need for food. And if we can figure out how to reduce waste and how to get the food that's available into the hands of the people that need it, I think that would be huge.
Cool. I like that. How about an inspirational tip or quote to help motivate listeners to reach into the dirt and start their own garden?
I would say if you can make food a priority in your life. I know that is difficult with people's busy schedule. It's hard, I'm sure, working a full-time job, being away from home all day, and finding the energy and the enthusiasm to go out and work in the garden. But I think making food a priority is so important for people's their health, for their emotional well-being. It's important to teach other people. So if you have kids, just to expose them to raising food. So I guess I would encourage people, and I hope that people would be inspired just to make food and growing food a priority in their lives, because I think it's just so important for the health overall.
Awesome. You've been just the most amazing guest. I'm thinking I might save this interview for New Year's Day, because this is just, you're like, you know, they always talk about when you're starting a business, or especially podcasters, like finding your avatar, like it's is your ideal reader or your ideal listener. And you just definitely fit the core of who my avatar is. And I think my listeners are really going to enjoy this. You've given us tons of golden nuggets and great ideas that'll work, you know, in Georgia or Montana or, you know, anywhere you're at. Just very inspirational and so important too. And I like the way, you know, a lot of my guests have talked, and my mom's always rolling her head and going, how did my daughter end up with a gardening podcast? Because I mean, she, like, it was so hard to get me. I didn't want to have anything to do with gardening when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And even today, like my husband, like I said, you know, he's the big gardener. And partly because I'm just so busy. Yeah. And then when I'm in the garden, I like to like paint or hang out or take pictures or, mm-hmm. I mean, there's days where I like to go down there and work, but for the most part, I'm, like you said, you know, I just almost always have a full-time job.
Yeah.
Plus putting out the podcast has been a lot. So, just,
yeah. Even if you can just make time to enjoy it, I think that's important. Just being in it, enjoying, you know, what your husband's creating, helping him to harvest it. I mean, that plays a huge part in it. Mm-hmm.
And cooking it, and like you said, teaching kids, because I've had a few guests on who have talked about, you know, that work in the schools and how some of the kids don't even know, like, a potato comes in the ground or a carrot grows in the ground. Like, our kids are, there's just this huge disconnect. And it's really nice. There is a good farm to school movement going on right now, and there's way more, you know, school gardens growing. But like you said, you know, you grew up, your babysitter and your parents had a big garden, and that even if you didn't participate as much as maybe just having that around. I was going to ask you, do you come from a big family? You talked about you and some other, like, were there a lot of kids in your family? Are you from a little family? Or?
Yeah, there's just two of us. I have an older sister.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. And just, you know, I think even if your kids give you a little resistance, just, you know, a lot of my guests have all said that their fondest memories are being in the garden with either their parents or their grandparents. So, you know, you might think the kids aren't really paying attention, but more soaks in. So
exactly.
I just like to encourage listeners to, you know, keep at it. And then, like you said, yeah, it is hard to come home. I was even thinking last night, I was like, oh my goodness, I don't know how parents do this sometimes, come home and feed the whole family after working every day. But then I always have regular work plus other jobs going as part of my deal. So yeah. Anyway, enough about me. Tell everybody, how do they connect with you? Give them your website again. And I think they will love it when they get there. There's some really sweet pictures of you and your husband. And it sounds like you guys have lots of information there.
Right. Yeah. That's where you can sign up for the blog. It's jennyjackfarm.com. That's JennyJackFarm.com.
Cool. Thank you so much for sharing with us today.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. And I really appreciate your kind words. You made me feel so good this morning.
Cool. Thanks. Thank you for listening to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'd like to encourage you to check out our website, organicgardenerpodcast.com. That's just organicgardenerpodcast.com. And you'll see the links to everything that we've talked about today in the show notes page and all the other episodes there. You can easily search for people by name. You can download our ebook on organic gardening basics and subscribe to our newsletter for updates and just different things that are going on. Thanks for listening, and remember to grow local.